Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. Now, there's no set schedule. It's just however I read the books, whatever kind of books that I read, I just do the review, stick it up here in the podcast feed. Except this time, we're going to do it a little bit differently. Maybe you can tell by the Skypeified recording quality that I'm using here, is that I'm actually going to do this book review with a friend of mine from the SFF audio podcast, Jesse. How are you doing, Jesse?
I'm good. How's it going?
Okay. How does the quality sound? Is it sounding good?
Sounds perfect. Yep.
Okay, that's great. So the reason I've invited Jesse on here is because this book that we're going to be reviewing today, The Invisible Man, was actually his idea. I said I'd put it onto my iPhone to read on the stanza, you know, because it's one of these very old books. Public domain. Is it public domain? It's probably public domain.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know it. I think actually some of H.G. Wells' books aren't public domain in some areas yet, but they will be next year or something like that, which is quite strange. But there you go. So, yeah, I said, hey, I've got The Invisible Man. And he said, well, I've got that in audio book and I'm going to listen to it on audio book and do a review for my website. And so we thought we'd do this together. And it was a bit of a question if this was going to be an SFF audio show on SFBRP. Show, but we decided.
Won.
Yeah, well, it's not that we won. It's just that Scott, the other co-host from the SFF audio, he was going to take part, but his wife's sick. You said, Jesse?
Yeah. She's not doing great right now, so he's taking care of her today.
Okay,
but he finished The Invisible Man, and he's all up to speed, so he's going to enjoy this podcast. I know he likes SFBRP quite a lot.
Okay. Well, that's cool. So, yeah, in case anybody doesn't know, I think I did put out a podcast with me and Jesse in conversation. It got quite a lot of good reactions. Quite a lot of people said, hey, it's good to have two people talking about the book. Now, normally I would never have two people talking about the book. Or let me put it this way. I'd love to have a co-host, a regular co-host, but it's very difficult to get two people to read the same book at the same time, at the same speed, and be ready to review stuff at the same, you know, together. Is it okay with film podcasts and stuff like that? But, you know, because you can just watch a film, it only takes a few hours. But book podcasts, I never really find a format that works. Either you go, like, one book per month to give everyone time to read it, or, you know, or it just doesn't work out at all. So, but this time, it wasn't planned. Well, it was sort of planned, but then...
And it's a short book, so it makes it easier to coordinate that, right? It's actually listed as a novella rather than a novel, but... I think it feels like novel length to me.
So quick edit there because I think I disconnected. This is another reason why doing a two-person podcast is a bit tricky, because either it works on Skype or it doesn't work on Skype. and we had a bit of cut out there. So anyway, let's just get straight into it, shall we?
Absolutely.
Jesse? Let's do it. So starting off with the bit of information about this book, it was written in 1897. Which was one of his one of H.G. Wells' very early books, and one of the oldest books that we've reviewed here on the SFBRP. It's about 278 pages long, and it's actually a very quick read. I'm not sure if those are old pages, like the first edition pages where they have lots of space, but it's not a big file when I download it onto my iPod, and you can get through it quite quickly. And also, it was set, you know, it's one of the like classic science fiction novels from H.G. Wells. If I say H.G. Wells, which are the books that immediately come to mind to you, Jesse?
War of the Worlds, certainly.
Yeah.
And I think you did another H.G. Wells.
Yeah, The Time Machine.
The Time Machine.
Yeah, I guess, but The Invisible Man is like the third one. I guess The Island of Dr. Moreau is like the fourth one. And after that, people start going... not quite sure. So those are like the four big ones, like the four classic ones that everyone.
Yeah, remembers. The first Men in the Moon, I think, is probably the fourth.
Yeah, that as well. Before. But I'm thinking The Invisible Man has had movies. All these other ones have had many movies made about them, whereas the other ones maybe not.
War of the Worlds, I would say, is number one, and maybe
definitely.
The Invisible Man
definitely
is sort of second tier. after.
Yeah, and I think the Time Machine is I think those are the top three ones with these other novels back a bit. So this is the second one we've done because I did review the Time Machine. So the world is set, as are all H.G. Wells novels, or many of H.G. Wells novels, in, of course, in the time that he was, or his readers were reading them, Victorian England. And this one, like The War of the Worlds, is set in the places that he grew up over in, the places that he knew over in West Sussex, which is, like a small village, and stuff happens in small villages. And then, of course, in the centre of London. And that's the thing that is a common theme with his novels, is that he likes destroying places in London. And it really is, it's one of those things that really appears. It's like, now you think about it as classic science fiction, but when he was writing it, science fiction didn't really exist as a form, as a genre as well. So he was writing, like with The War of the Worlds is known as invasion literature, and then this is very much like horror, in the same style that, you've got Frankenstein's monster, with a mad scientist creating a monster. That's the same thing that you've got here. And also with the Time Machine, I mentioned that there, you've got a lot of horror elements going on there with gribblers eating people, and it's the same kind of thing here. So while this is now classed as science fiction, is now classed as a science fiction classic, as it was written, it was very much a... what am I trying to say? Yeah, like not horror, but thriller kind of thing, but this was like the state of the art of the thriller there. So, the setting is pretty much as Victorian England and what you'd expect. The language, what do you think about the language, certainly at the beginning of the book, Jesse?
I think it's surprising how modern it is, I guess. It feels like, a lot of the characters are very Victorian speaking, but...
Yeah.
But the language that he's writing in is very modern, and as you say, it does sort of read like a thriller.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing about the world, which, or about the character as well, like that, as soon as you get into it, the story, like the first, say, quarter of the story is told from the point of view of a female character, which is very strange. Well, maybe not strange for that time, but almost quite strange for H.G. Wells or the novels that I've read of him before. Often there's not even a female character in the entire book, or like hardly mentioned by name, whereas here she's like the viewpoint character at the beginning. So the story goes like this. It turns out you actually got the second half of the story first and the first half of the story second, which is a bit confusing. So what happens is that you've got this, is it Iping? I can't remember.
Iping?
Well, I think it's Iping. Because
it could be Iping.
I'm British, and I think it's pronounced Iping, and I think I have the authority on this one.
I would guess so.
Rather than the Canadian here. So Iping, and a small town, and someone turns up, this strange character. You don't know his name at the beginning, and he's a bit gruff, he's a bit grim, and he's wanting to be left alone to work on his own experiments. And he turns up into this guest house, into this hotel, and is it Mrs. Hall? I can't remember the names of
Mrs.
the...
Yeah, Mrs. Hall.
Mrs. Hall, I didn't make a note down of all the different character names. Yeah, but Mrs. Hall turns up, and she didn't turn up. The man turns up, and he's got a like a fake nose, and he's got a hat pulled down over his head. So what we get at the very beginning of the novel is what it's like to meet an invisible man. So we don't even know who he is or how he's invisible or anything like that, or what it's like to be invisible. We just get the kind of, oh, what's going on here? What's going on here? And I guess when this was first published, it was serialized, I'm guessing, like all fiction was back then. So you're reading this and you're going, oh, who is this weirdo? So it actually, maybe it was published called The Invisible Man. So you sort of know.
It's sort of, yeah, you know what's going to happen. It's a spoiler, but...
Yeah, it is a spoiler, but just when you're reading it, of course you know he's the Invisible Man, but you're reading along from the point of view of people who don't know he's the Invisible Man. So it's sort of like, oh, someone catches him without his gloves on. It's like, oh, what's going on here? Or someone looks and he's not got his glasses on. He's got this hollow look about. So that actually goes on for quite a long time. Now this scene, because the Invisible Man or invisibility, or Harry Potter with his invisibility cloak and all these other stuff, It's so common now in not just science fiction, but in fantasy and all different kinds of stuff. But back then, I guess, sure, it would have been talked about before. I mean, it would have been written about before. But I guess for a lot of people, the notion of like scientific invisibility, sort of like if you're invisible.
I've got one story I've made a note of that came out in 1859 that is actually, it feels like a fantasy story at the beginning, but actually is very hard SF for the time. Being a monster that is invisible, a haunted house is haunted by a monster. They think it's just making noises. No, it's solid, and they catch it and they tie it up, and it's an invisible monster.
Yeah, but the thing I'm saying here is that, sure, that's fantasy, but here it's like, even though the idea of becoming invisible, we'll talk about that in a bit later, but it's dealt with in a science fiction way. It's sort of like, okay, if you were, okay, all of the things being equal, Victorian society being exactly how it is, the climate in the south of England being exactly how it is, what would you need to do to get by to be invisible? So I think just the treatment that everybody knows now of putting bandages around your head and wearing a hat and gloves, I think that's sort of like would have been new. I think, no, just, you know, of course I'm projecting here, but that kind of stuff would have been new to the people at the time. And that's what makes it quite an interesting read. It's like, okay, if there is an invisible person there, how would it work? You know, what would it be going on here and stuff? So that is one of those, well, not tricky things, but that's what you get like for that first sort of quarter of the book, sort of like a scientific investigation looked at from the outside, like the outsider's perspective of what it would be like to get around to be invisible. Is that what you get,
yeah,
Jesse?
I totally get that. And I mean, it's the meme has sort of developed since then. We see a lot of people putting on makeup over their invisible body to cover up. But at the time,
a latex mask in the Hollow Man, I think it was, wasn't it?
In smoke as well.
Yeah. We'll talk about it later. Yeah, he puts on a mask too.
Mm-hmm. I think that it is sort of, it's a curious sort of, the idea of invisibility does develop in the book, and it sort of follows logically from the actual problems that you would have if you were invisible.
This may be, I don't know if it is, but this might have been the first time where someone becomes invisible, like I say, in a scientific method, meaning that their clothes don't become invisible also.
Right.
And I think that's a key step in science fiction literature, the meme the tropes is that, okay, I'm invisible, but my clothes aren't, so now I have to get naked. And dealing with that kind of stuff is probably one of the first times that's been explored in depth here with H.G. Wells. And then moving on, I guess the next part of the book is told once the villagers, they sort of cotton on to what's going on. Then we get a bit about what it's like to work with someone who's invisible. We get point of view from the point of view character switches to the tramp, Thomas Marvel, and he's someone that the Invisible Man, who we know is called Griffin by now, he works for the Invisible Man. And then afterwards, once Griffin is being hunted down, the Invisible Man's being hunted down, we actually get his story. And this is what I said, like the second half of the story is first, then he meets up with someone and tells the story. I don't want to give too much away, but he tells the story of how he became invisible when he was living in London and stuff like that. And then that's actually like a whole story in its own right.
Yeah, a story within a story.
A story within
a story. Or backstory,
It's backstory, but it's not the backstory. That's actually the main story. If you understand what I mean, that's actually like the one of the important parts. However, this is something that I noticed quite often, and I've talked about it before in the podcast, which was it picked up with I mentioned it in the Fahrenheit 451 review that I did, which was when I was talking about when you've got lots of expository dialogue going on, or lots of people like filling in, one person filling in the information of another person, you've got to have something else going on in the background to give it dramatic tension. You can't just go, oh, and now I'm telling you the story. And that's what happened in Fahrenheit 451, where Beatty comes around and tells Montag about the history. It's like, this is why we're doing this, and this is why we're doing that, and this is why we're doing. And that would be quite boring, except that
Someone's trying to hide something.
He's trying to hide a book under his pillow, and it's sort of like, okay, and if they find the book, and if his wife finds the book under his pillow, you know, and there's a whole big thing going on there, not quite sure. And again, we get that. It would be quite a long, boring story, or it would be quite a break, but somehow, well, it's not somehow, you sort of see what's going on, is that people are hunting Griffin down, hunting the Invisible Man, and as he's telling the story, the person he's telling the story to is making his own plans and trying to work stuff out, and is calling in the police. So all the time that you're reading about Griffin telling the story of how he's becoming and how he became the Invisible Man and how he got his invisibility, you're also wondering, wait a second, the police are going to arrive any moment. The police are going to arrive, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's actually very well done, even though it breaks away from the narrative. It keeps you right there. And I think that is actually a very...
I think that's a very good point. I didn't actually break it down like the way you did, but it certainly is the case that, you know, there's a lot happening in each in each paragraph, in each sentence, we get a lot of action, and the story flows from that the machinations of each character's motivation. So when he first meets that bum or hobo, whatever we're going to call him, the man's you know, shocked and surprised and you know, probably questioning his sanity.
Oh, he is questioning. He's not probably questioning. He is, but
He's questioning his sanity. But
it's like someone's talking to me. God's talking to me. It's in my head. You know, there's all these different things that go through his mind.
I wonder if there's any significance to his name. I don't know. He's like marveling. I don't know.
Thomas Marvel.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he goes on to. I don't want to give it away at the end, but yes. I won't give it away. But yes, there might be something. I think there probably is something in the in his name there. I think what I was saying about there about covering the storytelling, like expository dialogue and stuff like that, with dramatic tension. If you ever get a chance, this is a tip for everyone. Download. I think I mentioned it before in the Fahrenheit 451 podcast. Download the Spielberg, Lucas, is it Lancaster? No, I can't remember the name of the other writer of the Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's like about 150 page PDF document.
Lawrence Kasdan.
Lawrence Kasdan, yeah, that was it. I don't know why I got Lancaster out of Lawrence Kasdan. Anyway, so they're talking about putting together I think I mentioned it to you before, Jesse. Mm-hmm. They're talking about putting together the story. And they have, they're saying, well, he needs to explain this. Yeah, but you can't just explain it. It's going to be really boring. Okay, so how we need to put some tension in there. Or how about someone's, like, they're telling the story in a tent and there's someone coming up and you see the shadow of the knife through the tent and someone's going to kill him and they get away. Yeah, knife is a bit. How about poison? Oh yeah, they're eating something that's poisonous, and then they go into it. So all they wanted to do was add tension to a scene. So then they make the scene have more tension that they're eating grapes. You know, he's throwing dates. He's throwing dates up and not quite catching them in your mouth. And you're all like, oh no, but it's poison. It's poison, you know. And then in the end, it's like, oh, how do they know it's poisoned? Oh, let's have an animal eat the poison and stuff and then die. Oh, let's have the rat eat the poison. Well, rat, you know, have the monkey. So then they put in the character of the monkey from Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then to be that, we're fine that the monkey dies, has been poisoned, which is quite brutal, actually, just to poison a monkey on the screen.
Evil monkey.
It was a Nazi monkey, wasn't it? Heil Hitler. And he actually did this. If you remember, but
it's glorious cover.
When you actually read them coming up with this idea, it's amazing, you know, of the, like, just the idea. It's like, oh, okay, this is going to be boring. Let's make it more interesting. I mean, I wish they'd have done stuff like this with their later films, you know, especially.
They seem to have just mined that initial brainstorming session and sort of it's gotten successively worse since then.
Yeah, but the point is, there's so many ideas in this 150-page story conference document that you can still see the same ideas. They're using that for the next two films. Literally, like, they're going, okay, and at the end, we'll have someone, you know, they'll jump out of a plane and they'll, you know, the plane will come down and they'll skid to a stop on the, you know, exactly the same scenes that are later put into. Certainly, there's a lot of stuff went into the second movie. But yeah, that's what's happening here. And I think it's a trick, and I don't really see it working on me like that until I go back and actually think about a novel.
Absolutely.
Or think about something I'm reading, and then I'm like, oh shit, that's what they're doing. You know, it's always catching
me out.
If
it's working on you, it's keeping you reading, right? It's keeping you engaged.
Yeah, that's definitely it. And so anyway, that's pretty much the story. And again, it does tell the story about how he became an invisible man, and that is because he is a mad scientist and he worked on it. So moving on to the character, and actually the mad scientist character, I think is very well done here, because it's a great anti-hero.
He's a real hateable guy.
Oh yeah, definitely. But you're rooting for him for so long, and you're like, no, but he's the invisible man. He's the titular character. He's the guy that we should be wanting to like, you know?
Yeah. It's really a hate, a love-hate relationship. You want to like them, but you can't.
You can't. And it's actually, I think, I mean, it's not a, it is actually quite a complex character. And that's one of the main sort of themes of the book, is like, okay, if you're invisible and you're isolated and you're shunned by society, I mean, you've shunned yourself from society. You've done it. It's like, will that bring out the intrinsic bad in you? Like, if you could suddenly take advantage of people, if you could steal things from people and get away with it because you're invisible, would you? And it's one of those things that everyone says, oh, I wish I was invisible. And it's like, why do you wish you were invisible? It's like, yeah, because I could do this cool stuff. And it's like, that cool stuff is actually quite bad. It's like if I said to you, what would you do if you were invisible? I'd go and spy on this person. It's like, does invisibility really bring out the worst in people?
So do you know the story of the Ring of Gyges? This is a part of Plato's Republic, just a tiny little section of the Republic. Well, you know, there's the story of Plato's Republic is basically he's talking about how to live a moral life and how society should be structured. Well, within the story of the Republic, the character of Socrates talks about a myth that they had, which is called the Ring of Gyges, which is a magic ring that turns you invisible.
Right.
And in the story, he's a murderer. The Gyges is a murderer and, a villain. And he wants to have sex with the queen of the land he's living in. He takes over the land and, you know, he becomes reviled and hated. What Plato is arguing is that given absolute power, you know, the ability to run free within a land, what would make someone morally restrained? And I think that this is clearly, you know, what's influencing the Invisible Man in the sense that he's given what we think would be a good power, right, the power to be invisible, but he's beset by so many of the frustrations that are incumbent with it actually being, you know, invisible. Yeah. You can't be dressed. You can't wear shoes. You can't, if you're going to steal something, you can't carry it because people see this thing flying through the street. Basically, you're a spy. That's all you can do is spy on other people and, you know, punch them in the head when they're not, they can't see you. That's about all you can do. So of course he is not actually a virtuous character doing it for virtuous reasons. He's quite a resentful asshole, actually.
Yeah. But I think that's to make it clear, that's why he gets Thomas Marvel, the beggar, not the beggar, the tramp, it's just to carry his books and to carry his case, isn't it? That's all he wants.
He needs a confederate. He needs a confederate. He can't do it alone.
He needs someone to work with him.
He realizes this eventually and picks him up.
But I think this is the key question about the characters and maybe all Invisible Man characters, even coming up to like Bilbo Baggins and Frodo Baggins, you know, in the Hobbit and the Lord of the Rings. Mm. It's like, what can you do invisible? What good can you do invisible? And it's really difficult, you know. I mean, unless you're going to go, okay, well, I'm going to go and spy on crocodiles so they can't see me, and I'm going to learn about crocodiles. You know, it's really difficult to come up with a good thing to do with invisibility, a way to be good with invisibility.
Or at least, completely good. There's been a couple of novels and movie that turn this one ability that is, you know, you could spy on other people into a good. So there's a book called Mrs. Pym's Camouflage, which is a lady is out in the garden one day and she turns completely invisible and she says, oh, well, since I've done this, now I can go off and work for the Allies during World War One. And she spies on the Nazis the Germans. And then there was a movie called The Invisible Spy, which was set during World War II, and it's the same thing. A guy parachutes into Nazi Germany, and he's spying on the high command. You really can't touch anything. You can't do anything. You can just be there, listening, reporting.
Yeah, I think but also getting back to the Invisible Man himself, Griffin, in the story here, I think from the very start, it's not invisibility that makes him that way.
No.
It really isn't. I mean, for example, we find out that he stole money from his father, and then because his father was now broke, because he didn't realize who... I mean, this was before he was invisible, because he needed money for his experiments. His father committed suicide, and it's like Griffin just doesn't have any kind of remorse or regret for that. It's just like, oh, well, he committed suicide. He should have been stronger.
Yeah.
So it's like he starts off with the, like, you know, being a complete, you know, maniac in a way, this mad scientist character, and the invisibility really does push him over the edge. And I think that's again what you said before. It's like when you've got that much power, and in the book he does want, he's like, okay, I'm gonna have a reign of terror. And that, as soon as it gets to that part, you're actually, that's the moment when he mentions the reign of terror, that's the moment where you go, actually this guy...
He's unredeemable.
Yeah, I was going to put that. There's no way to redeem this character. He is... I'm now on the side of the mob. And when you look at that, you're like, okay, I'm on the side of the mob, you know. And it's at that moment when he says, I'm going to start my reign of terror, and you can be with me in it. And the character that he's talking to at the time, Kemp, a fellow scientist, that's the time when he realizes, it's like, okay, that's it. and you know, we all have that same realization at the same time. But I do think this is one of the, what makes The Invisible Man, or the story of The Invisible Man, resounds so much, is because, like I say, that, you know, the invisibility, the impact that it has on you. And it's not just like, oh, I can't wear clothes, so I'm really cold. You know, there's that whole, like, being isolated, nobody looking at you. And, you know, that comes across as well in the other book that we're going to talk about in a minute as well, Smoke by Donald Westlake. But
I wanted to bring up one other point in my research about this book, invisibility. Someone linked to a Wikipedia entry that I think is kind of interesting. You know, the thing is if you're invisible, you have power over other people, or at least the ability to do damage without being accountable for it. Yes. And they pointed out that this is very similar to the online anonymity yeah. of internet chat. So you can, you know, say someone's a jerk, or you know, spread lies,
and spam about it. Yeah.
If you can, you know, hide behind an internet handle, or you know, just an anonymous thing, or just post it anonymously, it's very similar. And so we have this effect we call, you know, I guess trolls, internet trolls. Somebody's just a hater, and you know, the question is, you know, this is a way of judging moral character in a way, but without being able to attribute it. But as a whole, perhaps we could say, you know, if there are more internet trolls than there are internet friends, you know, fairies or whatever, something that is generous, and then we could say, you know, whether people truly are, as Plato would argue, you know, inherently power mad, inherently.
I think it's more of a selection bias by the internet, that people with more time on their hands and stuff like that actually have the time to do that, whereas all the rest of the people, the good people, don't do that because they're actually just getting on with life.
You'd have to take that into effect. I mean, the way Griffin talks is what he does and what he says is. He's coming at it from he feels he's been unjustly
done down in life.
And yet he thinks, you know, his research is should be entirely his own. He deserves all the credit, and that no one should question his greatness, I guess.
Yep.
And the problem with that is, of course, if everybody acted like that, we wouldn't be able to live. He is just a horrible character. But as Eric Rabkin pointed out, you know, he also is flawed in his genetics, right? His genetics are flawed in such a way that he can't. He is probably being discriminated against prior to his invisibility. You know, without giving too much away.
Let's just talk a bit about that as well. I know it's sort of mentioned quite passing in the book, but coming on now from the characters, bottom of the technology, which I always talk about here on my podcast, or you know, science and technology, is that the idea is that how he comes, you know, he does become invisible in a technological way. And the idea, which is quite a good one, is that water in water has the same refraction. Is it the same refraction index, isn't it, that he's talking about?
It's glass. So
if he can make his body with the same refraction index as the air around it, he'd be invisible. But it's not just the refraction index, then it also has to, it can't have anything
sharp edges,
any sharp edges, but also it can't have anything with pigment in it, because pigment will block the light,
right?
You know, so it just so happens that he is an albino, and as soon as it mentions that, he mentions that he was an albino before he talks about how he became invisible. but then you that immediately made me think, oh, okay, that's right. But then also at the same time, you do realize that by being an albino, he would have been he would have stood out and would have been like you say, shunned from society for his genetics as well as his character, or maybe his character came from his genetics as well. So
it's a good twist.
Yeah, again, it's a strange one, but it is there. It is there. It's sort of like, okay, yeah, you remember me. I was the albino. And he's like, oh, yeah, of course. So when you're identified for your skin color or your hair color or your red eyes, or no, I don't think actually albinos have red eyes. You know, so I think that's a bit of a myth. So that's it. But the technology isn't explained. It's sort of like large parts of it are explained, like the whole refraction index and the pigment and stuff like that. But when it actually comes down
to... He uses a very... in the same way he does in the Time Machine, H.G. Wells.
Yeah.
Makes a damn compelling case, metaphorically, how something could like this could happen. It is a sleight of hand in the sense that really, he hasn't told you exactly what he's done, right?
He hasn't told you anything about what he's done. He just uses a little bit of jargon.
But it's not, it's the talks way about that he... formulas and stuff, but that's not really what the focus is. Is look at this interesting point about light and matter and how they interact in our world. And there are invisible things. For example, air is invisible, right? We can't see it, except when we can.
The best point that he brings up is that in water, lots of things are invisible in water.
Yes.
And I really like that idea. Like if you you can see a glass, but when you then drop a glass into water, suddenly it disappears because you know it's got a similar
refraction index.
And I think that's very well. But he does this again in the Time Machine. He's saying like, yeah, but if it goes through time, why can't we see it when it's traveling through time? And he says, well, it's like if something's traveling really quickly through space, it's only there for a tiny little, it's only there for a second, you know. Mm-hmm. He says, well, it's the same when it's traveling through time, but it works the other way. So it's not just there for a second, it's only there for less of a physical thing, you know. So that's why time travel, you can always get away from it because you're actually skipping into the other dimension. And when things are traveling through space, they're in each position for a tiny amount of time. And when, things are traveling through time, they're only in space for a tiny fraction of the space. And when you think of it that way, you're just like, oh yeah, of course you can travel through
course.
Time. And
it is a complete sleight of hand, but it's so masterful that you end up almost thinking of it as hard SF, you know.
Yes.
You've been fully persuaded. I think the point at which I realized, you know, this guy is the master of science fiction was when he talks about, you know, he is talking about the glass. You put the glass in, you know, in the air, you can see it. You put it in the water, you can't. You smash it up, and you look at it on the table. It's white, right? It's not just you can see it. It's actually more visible. But if you take those smashed up pieces of glass and you put them into the water, they become completely invisible again. Yeah. And then he makes an analogy how his own body, denuded of pigment, added this medium, you know, his formula.
Yeah, it's like some concoction of drugs and stuff, isn't it?
Right, some sort of strange... some sort of strange chemical creation. When he takes that in, it has the same effect as the water on the smashed-up glass. And you say, oh, yes, okay, I see exactly what he's done. And it is logical, and you almost say, well, I guess scientists could... go about doing this, right?
But the funny thing is, after he sets all up and he says, yes, this is it, this is it, this is it, and then I used some kind of whirling some kind of device, and he just says it and he just goes, which is too complicated to explain now. And it's in this exactly the same way that he does that in the Time Machine as well. He just goes, well, just imagine this, traveling through time, and it all works. Okay, so just step into this circular frame and we'll start it up and we'll do it. And it's like, oh, okay. And then you're like, wait a second. And you're like, oh, let's just get on with the story. And it is very clever like that. And I think that's what I really like about this mastery of the science fiction genre, even before it was one, that he would set it up in such a way that you're just like, yeah, of course, faster than light travel is possible. Look, they've just said it. Look, and you can do this. And then it just goes, okay, so we'll just engage the light drive and go. And you're like, okay. And then you're like, no, wait a second. Yep. How does the light drive work? And you're like, don't worry.
You can only think about it after the novel's over and you're sort of, well, wait a second. But
yeah.
During the process, you're totally with him. And
yeah,
I think if he had written a Faster Than Light novel, you know, a story with Faster Than Light, I would have been convinced. Because based on everything he's done so far, I've been convinced.
Well, the thing is, I just looked on Wikipedia, and there's this huge list of novels there, and I've only read like 5 or 6 of them. So maybe it's the ones where it works. Those are the ones we're still reading today rather than the other way around.
There's a lot of short stories that I've read of his, and they tend to be pretty damn good in themselves. I mean, one of them is called The Crystal Egg. It's an egg that turns up in a pawn shop, and it actually, if you turn the lights down low, or you cover it, you put your head under a piece of cloth and look into it, you can actually see things
you see
happening
Mars
on another,
or something, don't you?
On another planet. It turns out it's Mars, right? It's a long distance communication piece of equipment that's somehow turned up on Earth. It's fascinating, but it's also a vignette. It doesn't have a story other than just an idea. And so what we were sort of left with is the grand stories rather than
as the small ideas. Yeah. That's actually a good point there. Anyway,
I think from my reading, The Island of Dr. Moreau should probably be have a higher estimation of in the public consciousness, especially now with all the genetic engineering that's.
I should revisit that one actually as well, I think. And I'll do these four. I was mentioning to you before about the War of the Worlds and how I've read that a few times in the past year, but not reviewed it. It's been for a writing project that I'm doing. But I'll get onto that later. Back to the tech as well. You mentioned before this was your big thing that you wanted to say. Hey, what if you're invisible?
There's one serious problem.
What I do
now when I talk about this book, I say, what's the big problem with invisibility? The only person to have ever got it straight out of the bat is you. When I've said, so what is the big problem with invisibility, Luke?
Yeah, well, I just said, if you're invisible, your irises don't work to keep the light, and the lens at the front of your eye doesn't work to keep the light.
There's no retina to receive it.
And then the retina is not blocking any light, and so that doesn't work either. So all of the three main parts of the eye that you need to see need to be able to change light in some way, and that is the iris and the cornea and the retina
to receive the information,
retina,
right? So even if you had all of those things, you know, a small retina at the back and you had an iris at the front, and right, you still wouldn't be able to see because you need the shroud that is the eyeball itself.
Yes, right? Yes, of course. Like the camera body as well.
Exactly,
as
right. You can't have a camera that's just a piece of film. It doesn't work, right?
Yes, that's true.
So the main problem with being invisible is you would be completely blind.
Yes. However, I do think that's mentioned with he makes the cat invisible, and it does say the cat's irises were floating around.
But notice his aren't. Right?
Or nobody sees them anyway. Yeah. Yes, it is a problem. It is a problem, but you've just got to go with it.
I think that might have been his hint that he knew that, you know.
Yes. This is a problem. Yeah, I think.
And he just sort of said, you know what, it's still a great idea for a novel, and it's as with all of, I think, all of his novels that we've talked about so far, I think that the primary concern is actually not the science. That is actually how he differs his stuff from a lot of other novels, makes them a lot more plausible. But what he has in the background is, that he is actually making an analogous story, right? So for the time machine, what is the background? It's Darwinism, right?
Yeah. Well, it's really just talking about evolution. It's a sort of like future evolution of humans.
Or devolution, exactly.
Yeah, devolution or back evolution, you know, sort of like...
And the human destiny, you know, we're not going to
be on
this.
But also as well, he's talking about the class society, like the class system here. Okay, I guess we're getting on to the themes of this book here as well. And and with the War of the Worlds, it was like, I say, it's invasion literature, but it is very much talking about sort of like...
The
colonial system that they have there, the British just turning up. There's a great there's a great Eddie Izzard sketch, and he goes, it's sort of like, yes, you just need flags to conquer the world. It's like, go to India and you put your flag down. And it's like, this is us. We're claiming it for us. And like the Indians are going, wait a second, this is our country. It's like, do you have a flag? Like, no, we don't have a flag, but it's ours. It's like, but this is our flag. It's like, yeah, but this is our land. It's like, okay, but we have guns.
Trumping
like,
technology, yeah.
Yeah, so it's one of those things. It's just a flag. That's what you need. You need to conquer the world. You need flags. Yeah, it's a great sketch, but that is pretty much what the War of the Worlds is about. And here, I think he's doing something very clever. With again, he's not talking about like society is like on an empire colonial level. He's not even talking about it on a class level in the same way that that the Time Machine was talking about when you went forward and you got the Morlocks and the Eloids. But here he's talking very much on a personal level. It's sort of like personal
responsibility.
Moral character, but also the idea of isolation and what happens when someone is shunned from society. Now, in this case, as I mentioned before, he's doing the shunning himself. You know, Griffin is doing the shunning himself by removing him from society. But then there's like, okay, he's an albino, and so it's. I don't think it's.
Well, it's not just him too, right? Marvel is.
Yes, that's
sort
what
of isolated
I want.
By his.
Yeah,
his
I was going to bring that up as well. Did I bring it up? I can't remember if I mentioned this before. That I want that the tramp that he works with. This is suddenly he meets the tramp, and the tramp is like, "Oh yes, this is my way back in, and it's going to be great because now I've got a friend and someone actually cares about me." And then you realize, no, he doesn't really care about you. But yeah, there is a lot going on there about, you know, looking after people who are the so low in society, and it's very great sort of social commentary in a way, yet wrapped up in this very popularist, you know, Frankenstein's monster kind of setup. Well, not Frankenstein's monster, but you know, this thriller, you know, horror story with a, you know, a mad scientist. But it really does bring back it. Oh no, I realize why I mentioned it. I just looked at my notes here when I under themes. I put down great power, isolation equals madness, and I put the tramp thinks he's found a way to no longer be isolated, and that's why I thought I mentioned it before, because I obviously thought about it earlier when I made these notes.
It's true. It's true. A person who is out, you know, who has no one to dialogue with, especially on their own level, you know, which he, you know, he's Griffin is teamed up with Marvel. Marvel is not a scientist. He is, you know, alcoholic, I guess.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, just surviving, right? He has a dog, doesn't he? I think he has a dog.
I can't remember his dog.
Okay,
I don't think there was dogs in there, because of course the dogs know that the Invisible Man's there right away.
Right.
But I don't think Marvel had a dog.
Okay.
Maybe I can't remember.
I could be wrong. In any case, he doesn't have he is a parallel to Griffin, Marvel.
Yes.
But he also doesn't have the basically ruinous moral character that does Marvel. Griffin takes on sort of all the aspects he had as a regular person with his invisibility. I mean, he's not a better person before or after, right?
Yeah.
He just stays the same, but because he is invisible and isolated by that invisibility, he The only thing that restrains him is some, and he's very bad at it. I mean, just his dealings with Mrs. Hall, right?
Oh yeah.
He's trying to solve all the problems with money, right?
Yes.
He can't just, you know, answer a few questions and be polite to someone he thinks is his moral inferior or his intellectual inferior. He just is very frustrated, and we feel, you know, sympathetic to his frustration. But not
his methods.
Absolutely not his methods. But his resentment is so strong, his contempt is so strong that he can't even keep up. I mean, there's no reason for him to have fallen into that, into what happens to him, except from his moral character, right?
Yeah.
There's no requirement that he turn into this moral reprobate as he is.
Yeah. That is true. So, one final thing about the writing style, and then we'll wrap it up and talk a bit about this other book that we wanted to talk about. What do you think about the actual... We mentioned it before, but I don't actually think this is written as well as The Time Machine or War of the Worlds. I think those are better written books. I think mainly because they have a more consistent... they're written more consistently. For example, this one, it starts off with in one place and then it goes to another viewpoint and then it goes back and does this other story, which is an interesting way of telling the story, but it suffers from not having like one viewpoint character. Now, I know War of the Worlds actually has two. There's the unnamed protagonist and then his brother, and they go off and do different things, and and they tell both stories. And also the Time Machine, it's like I say, there's that frame story and the one guy goes off and then comes back and then tells his story. Whereas this, it didn't really have that proper structure, and I think it suffered a bit from that. What do you think?
I wouldn't say it's probably the nature of the beast in the ways he wanted to tell the story.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, one thing I did notice about, especially the introductory sequence, it actually reminded me quite a lot of Treasure Island. If you remember the beginning of Treasure Island, there's the young boy works I can't remember his name. Anyway, he works at Mr. Hawkins, right?
Yeah.
He works in a bar hotel on the seaside of England, Dover or something like that. Something very out of the way.
Yeah.
They get a very strange guest, right?
Yeah.
Who, he's, while not invisible, wants to be invisible, right? He's looking to avoid someone who's looking for him. Turns out that's Long John Silver. Not Long John Silver, but a notorious pirate who's hiding out. In the same way, it's a very curious introduction to the story. Now, the parallel basically ends there, but it feels like a very natural way to start a story. You know, you introduce a character into an environment. Where would you do that? Hotel makes sense.
Yeah,
small hotel makes sense. I can.
You've got less characters to keep track of.
Yeah, and also it's sort of as John Cleese was saying, the explanation for why Fawlty Towers was set in a hotel as opposed to anywhere else is everybody knows what a hotel is like, so you don't have to do all the building up of the environment. Mm-hmm. So if
that
you set a story on a fishing boat, right, you would have to explain all the fishing terms.
First. Yeah.
Right, and that you don't really want to do that. You just want to get into the story.
That is
so
true.
It's a very natural place to start a story, and I think it works very well.
Yeah, I do think that's well. I'm just saying that overall, I don't think this is put together quite as well. Actually, to be honest, that is true, because thinking now about the War of the Worlds, it starts off, and the guy he works in a newspaper, and then he goes to an observatory, but you don't really have you don't really know what the observatory is like. It's just he moves there, you know, he goes there, and now. From Victorian England, we know what a Victorian hotel looks like or a Victorian public house looks like.
Yeah.
But a Victorian observatory, I can't really picture that in my mind. And there's other things that he talks about in that novel and in other novels as well. And he says, oh, yes, and I went here. And I'm like, well, what was that like? But, yeah, I see in this book, he just goes, well, I was in a village and there was a village fete going on and there was a hotel and I went in there. And, yeah, I understand what you mean. Mm. You don't need to worry about it. You know, you don't have to.
It's all shorthanded for us. So the preposterous, but the fantastic elements are, it is not impossible for a man covered in bandages to walk into a hotel. It's completely likely if you are covered in bandages that you might need a hotel. However, it's unusual and interesting. And the way the man acts is so strange that, you know, eventually, things come to a head, as it were. But in fact, they're very similar characters. The pirate in Treasure Island, the secretive pirate who's always singing his rum songs or whatever it is. Shiver Me Timbers.
His name is Bones, I think.
Is his name Bones? Okay, could be right. They're both sort of horrible characters. Living in a hotel, paying their way as it's like they can't have anyone who would put them up, right? Because they have no friends.
Yeah.
No, nobody would say, oh, come on, stay with me for a while, right? No, it's like I've thrown out all, you know, I've become such a jerk that I have to go to strangers and pay them to let me live with them because I can't.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
Maybe taking it too far, but...
No, I can see what you're getting at there.
It's also good for the story.
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, because of course he's so isolated, he can't go, oh, I'm invisible. Oh, he needs to go and meet someone and I'll explain to them what's happened. He doesn't have anyone.
Well, he does that eventually, right? He does that eventually.
Yeah, he tries it.
But he's so pathetically unable to convince people of... I mean, in that way, he's not a psychopath, right? The psychopaths are very good at convincing people that they are...
He's more of a, I don't know, sociopath. No, I don't know. He doesn't have any. This is Griffin we're talking about. He doesn't have any way to connect.
He has no sympathy for anyone else's position, and he's very selfish. But he is not good at hiding any of those things. Right?
Yeah. Okay, then. So my rating, I know you don't give ratings on your reviews and stuff, but I'm going to rate this. It's because I've read it before and the characters and so I mean, it's not, I don't think it's as good as the other one. I'm going to give it 3 stars, maybe a bit more, maybe 3.5 stars or something like that. But it is a very short read, which is good. And if you want to just read it in 5 hours, so that's my wrapping up the review here. What do you think overall of the book, The Invisible Man?
It's I think it's probably, you know, the definitive work on the subject, and I also think that invisibility is not a great subject to begin with.
Right? I think it's very difficult.
It's very difficult, just given the one basic, you know, fallout from that you're blind. if you're doing it as a science fiction story, I think it's a non-starter. Other than this, right? You really can't do much with it. No. If you're doing it for other reasons, or you're doing it in a fantasy element, there might be some redemption there. I always thought, for example, in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, that the invisibility was sort of not important at all to the story.
Oh, no, that wasn't it. Yeah, it wasn't important to
curious.
The story. Because
it's curious.
It was curious. But the point is, in The Hobbit, giving a spoiler here, he was never always meant to be invisible. It was an accident. You know, that was just something that was fortuitous and... Only...
Yeah, but as a burglar, it's kind of helpful, especially
when... Yes, I know, and that's why he was never any good as a burglar. But then it's only when it comes right to the end of the book of The Hobbit where he's suddenly like, I can help out here, and it was always just one of these little things that he'd been using now and then, but not really understanding it up until the.
I also think it's interesting that in Lord of the Rings, you know, the development of the idea of invisibility is. That it only makes you invisible to the people who are around you. It doesn't make you invisible to the eye of Sauron, right? In fact, it's a magnifier to all the ringwraiths nearby, and in that sense, it is sort of neutralized, right?
Yes, it is.
But on the other hand, I think that Tolkien is, you know, a scholar of such note that he is perfectly aware of the Ring of Gyges myth, and that this does fit in with his story development. Given that, you know, it could be used in the hands of someone evil, like, I don't know, Sauron, or even who's the king of the
Saruman?
No, the king of the Rohirrim, the other guy, king of Gondor,
I don't know. I'm not a big Lord
Anyways,
of the Rings geek.
Everybody wants to seize the ring from Frodo, right? And they want to do it for the good reason. So Boromir, right?
He's like, give me the ring. Yeah, yeah.
He says, give me the ring. You don't know what we could do with it. I'm a good person, right? And yet he's almost willing to kill Frodo over this, right? So that's showing
only,
that he doesn't have
it. It's only Gandalf who actually sees the ring and is like, no, this is too much. You know, he knows what's going on.
Has this speech about, you know, how I'm very, very good, right, says Gandalf. And if you give me the ring, I will be good and terrible, right? And terrible. And in a way, it is a very, maybe that's the definitive work of fantasy for invisibility.
Yeah.
I think that is a bit too
huge to talk about.
Let
me put it this way: the Lord of the Rings could be the prime example of many, many, many themes. I think there's the podcast Film Spotting. They do a top five every week. They do a top five this and a top five movies about this, top five movies about this. But the point is, there's so many great films which could make so many top five lists that they're disqualified from the top five list. Because if you go, okay, a film about family, and they're going, oh, Godfather, yeah. A film about, you know, this. And, oh, The Godfather.
Prime,
Yeah, and The Godfather would come out on, like, make every list. So they have the pantheon that they put these films in which are too good to include as, the greatest statements of a single theme or idea.
You know what? I think that that's a very clever way to do it because...
Yes.
It's like...
I think they came,
the
I think
awards
it came out...
From... They don't talk about the same movies over and over again. I think the point of any list like that is to let people know of something that they would otherwise like that they haven't heard of.
Yeah, right? Yeah, definitely.
So they look at the list and they say, oh, I've seen those three and I agree with those three on the list. What's this fourth one? I don't know about this one. I'll watch that.
Yeah, yeah.
So in that case, it makes complete sense.
So our list of invisibility includes this. No. Okay, so that's it. Let's wrap up this podcast here. And we'll start, because we've been going for about an hour now or something about this. It's been...
About that.
Yeah. So what we'll do, we'll start a new podcast in like 2 minutes and put it out as a separate one about the next novel. Yeah? Should we do that way?
Okay. Is there enough to talk about on that?
Well, it can be a short podcast. This has been a long podcast, so we'll do a short podcast. It'll be fine.
Okay.
So let's wrap this one up. My name's Luke Burridge. I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Jesse has been with us. He'll be back in the next podcast, which I'll release at the same time. And so if you've enjoyed this, Jesse, where can people get hold of you and listen to you and read you in your reviews, book reviews?
sffaudio.com. Science fiction fantasy audio.
Yeah, and what do you do there?
I'm the webmaster. I don't know. I just write lots of reviews and link to online audio that's available on LibriVox and anywhere else on the internet that's good to listen to.
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, and you can catch me on my website, which is lukeburridge.com/blog. I'm putting up lots of stuff there. And also on Twitter, I'm Luke Burridge. You're SFF Audio on Twitter, aren't you?
Yeah, it's mostly just our RSS feed for the website. I don't.
Yeah, that's true, actually, Twitter, isn't it? It puts through... I mean, I'm subscribed to it because it's good to... Because I don't want to subscribe to your full blog. Although I read
the headline and see what's linked.
Yeah, yeah, it's good stuff. Anyway, I'm Luke Burge on Twitter, and you can also follow me on goodreads.com, which is the best way to recommend books to me and keep up with what I'm reading at the moment. Otherwise, email me, luke@juggler.net, and say if you've enjoyed this podcast, because I know it's a bit of a one-off. Well, I say it's a one-off, because we're going to do another one immediately now. So otherwise, I'll see you later.
Good.
Okay, that's cool, Jesse. Let's just start the next one then, shall we?
Okay.
I know this will just be a short one, because I don't have a lot to say, but it'll be a good thing to have a companion podcast, because otherwise that would have been... That would run to an hour and a half, and I've done very long podcasts recently. I don't want to get the
short ones in.
Yeah, a few shorter ones as well. So, are you going to press record again, or are you just
still, we'll just keep recording, and I'll break it up into two files.
No, you just send it to me, and I'll break it up.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, I'm just going to leave a bit of a pause here.